Okay. Now we're what's that? Not balance. Yeah. Our subject tonight, I guess it's obvious, is going to be the 3 weeks. To begin the 3 weeks, it's always a certain sense of, you know, that I used to feel just kind of like confusion. You're not quite sure what to make of it. Often just turns into kind of like just a stressful period of, you're supposed to be sad, you're not quite sure about what. It's hard to feel sad when you're not sad, so you just kind of end up feeling guilty. And then it just kind of turns into just like an uncomfortable period, more than a sad period, that you're just kind of waiting to get it over with so that you can just feel comfortable again. So, yeah. And also especially the feeling of when you do want to connect, but you don't really, it's hard to exactly feel what you're supposed to be feeling. So, we often preface our discussions about different moyadim, about the times of the year, with a humorous anecdote that I want to use here also. You heard it here one more time. That Rav Shimshon Pinkus always said that as a kid he found it amusing that whenever a darshan spoke about a particular time of the year, it was always made out to be that that was the most fundamental part of the year. Talking about Pesach, Pesach was the, you know, the what it's all based on, and everything boils about Pesach, and Pesach is the Yisoid of Emunah, and everything about Yiddishkeit is based on Pesach. Then he hears the darshan speaking about Purim, and somehow or the other, everything really is based on Purim. Right? Purim is the Yisoid of Yiddishkeit. Hanukkah, the same thing. He said as a kid he found it funny, and then when he grew up and started speaking, he found himself doing the same thing. Speak about Pesach. Pesach is the most fundamental Yom Tov, the Yisoid of everything. Shavuos, oh, the Yisoid of everything. But he said, but then I understood that it's really so. When you have a convention of doctors, and each one is talking about his specialty, and the neurologist goes on and on about how the brain is the most vital organ there is, and showing how everything depends on the brain, and there's nothing without a brain. Then the cardiologist gets up and says all the same things about the heart. Right? Then you have the kidneyist, whatever you call him, who gets, what's that? Nephrologist. That's already beyond my so the nephrologist gets up and he goes on about the kidneys. Now, any of that making an overstatement? No, the body has multiple vital organs, each contributing its own thing, and without which the body wouldn't run. Right? The lungs represent the respiratory system, very important part of the body. Then you have the heart, which is the blood. Then you have the brain. So the truth is that this really is true for the Yom Tovim as well. The Yom Tovim are not a haphazard collection. Actually, I should use the term Moyadim in this context, more specifically than Yom Tovim. The Moyadim are not a haphazard collection of commemorations of historic events. This one happened to happen then, that one happened to happen then, and we commemorate, and as time went on, we accumulated a collection of Yom Tovim. No, that's not how it is. The Yom Tov, the Moyadim, the cycle of the Jewish year, contains different elements that are fundamental to the Jewish consciousness, that are fundamental to the Jew as a person. What Pesach contributes is fundamental, vital. We spend 8 days focusing on it, not for the purpose of focusing on it on Pesach, 7 days, I'm sorry. Not for the purpose of focusing on it on Pesach, but for the purpose of imprinting it in our minds such that it carries us over until the next Pesach. Sukkot conveys a fundamental message, a different message, but each of which are vital. And this is true for the whole cycle of the Jewish calendar. Sukkot, Shmini Atzeres, Chanukah, Purim, Pesach, Shavuos, Yom Ha'Nevuim, of course, and the same applies for the 3 weeks, for what we call Bein HaMitzarim, meaning that whole system of the 3 weeks, the 9 days, Tisha B'Av, Bein HaMitzarim, are a very fundamental part of this system. They Chazal say that the Imam Bein HaMitzarim are called a Moyed, right? Shor Pasuk Kara Alayim Moyed Yishmo Bachurai. Echa refers to in Echa Yirmiyahu HaNavi refers to the events as a Moyed, which simply understood simply means it was a designated time in the year. But Chazal take this very seriously and they say no, Tisha B'Av is a Moyed. Now sounds like a joke, but Chazal take the joke further. That's why we don't say Tachlun on Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av is a Moyed. We're not playing music, we're not having Suda, there's no Kiddush. But you see that Chazal took this very seriously. It's not just a joke, there must be profundity here. It's not just a pun. There's no Tachlun because it's a Moyed. How are we to understand this? What's the Moyed? The truth is that really it's a part of what we've been discussing about what the essence of the Jewish calendar is. What does the word Moyed mean? The word Moyed means Lehi Va'ed. It's from the term Va'ad. Va'ad means a gathering. On the Moyadim we gather with Hashem, we get together with Hashem for the purpose of strengthening, renewing, rejuvenating our relationship with Him. And each of the different Moyadim does that in a different way. All together, the whole conglomerate of Moyadim constitutes the fully balanced picture of all the different fundamental points that the Jew has to have in his consciousness all year round. Moyad of Tisha B'Av is the same thing. Moyad of Tisha B'Av is also a time in which we rejuvenate, renew, we get back together with Hashem in a sense. In a sense, as we'll see soon. It's a time of Va'ad, the time of Lehiva Eid, when we reconnect with Hashem just like in any of the other Yomim Tovim. However, we certainly know that Tisha B'Av carries a different atmosphere than the rest of the Yomim Tovim. It's not called a Yom Tov, certainly not. It's called a Moyed. It's not a Yom Tov. So there's something very different about the nature of Tisha B'Av. Even though, yes, this quality of Moyed it does have. The way Avolda put it is, Shem Avolda and Alei Shur, and this is what we'll elaborate on now. He says, it's a different sort of Moyed. We have Moyadim that are Moyadim of what we call Kirva, closeness. It's a Moyed. Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuos, when we had the Beis HaMikdash, it meant that we were going to Yerushalayim to actually get together with Hashem in the most literal way. Today we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. It's part of what we're going to be busy with these 3 weeks. But even so, the Moyadim, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot remain a time of closeness. Tisha B'Av is a Moyed of Richuk, a Moyed of distance. Meaning, we renew our relationship with Hashem. Or, we'll put it paradoxically, we draw closer to Hashem. We invigorate our relationship with Hashem from the perspective of distance. What does that mean? And this is really what we're going to be discussing now. Said that Rav Nachman of Breslov was one time walking with his Talmidim. I guess I'm a Likvat, so I'm not saying with his Chassidim, but whatever it is, okay. He was walking with his Talmidim and they saw a young girl crying. And they're in the street, girl standing by herself and crying. So he asked her, why are you crying? So she said, I was playing hide and seek with my friends. And I hid very well. Everybody else had been found, and they're all searching together. And nobody was finding me. It was thrilling. And then they decided, you know what? Forget about it. We're going to go play something else. They went to play, instead of continuing to look for her, they went to play something else, and that's it. They're involved in some other game somewhere else. And that's why she was crying. So, Nachman apparently comforted her, etc. But then afterwards he said to his Talmidim, he said, this pinpoints exactly what the tragedy of the Churban is. Exactly what the tragedy of the Golus is for us. Hashem, in order to shake us, in order to give us a jolt, in order to shake us out of complacency, in order to shake us out of a downhill slide, hid. He left us, Kiryach. The idea being, and this is what actually did happen at the time, to shake us, to jolt us, to come looking for him desperately, to try to get back together with him. It's unbearable. We can't bear to live without him. But before we manage to reach that desired state, complacency set in, and we said, you know what? If we can't find Hashem, we'll play a different game. The Golus is not all that bad. There's a good time to be had here too. You just have to adjust. And started adjusting, and we get used to a new reality. And that's that. And the result is that, yes, when the 3 weeks come around, again, it's just a feeling of discomfort. We've got to get through this in order to be able to move on with vacation. And that's the tragedy. Hashem is staying hiding, and nobody's looking for him. Siyon hi ein deresh lo. Yes, Siyon. Nobody's seeking it out. So you have to realize, Siyon is not a geographical issue. Of course, we can come back to the geographical place. We're here now. But the question is, what are we looking for in Zion? So here we have to take a step back and go back, mamish, to the fundamentals. What is the Jew? We bought this home many times, let's bring it home again. What is the Jew? What is the fundamental definition of a Jew? The fundamental definition of a Jew is not a person who believes in Hashem, first of all. Because all goyim are expected to believe in Hashem. A. B. A Jew who does not believe in Hashem is a Jew. So that can't be the definition of a Jew. Is it just a racial thing? And there's no real inherent difference between a Jew and a Slav, except that this one happens to be a Jew and that one happens to be a Slav. What is the inherent definition, the essential definition of what a Jew is? So again, it can't be Emunah, can't be keeping mitzvahs, because once again, as we said, a Jew who doesn't keep mitzvahs remains a Jew. A Jew with shortcomings, but he remains a Jew. The fundamental definition of a Jew is a person who is bonded with Hashem. Now, what do I mean by bonded with Hashem? That's a little bit abstract. We'll put it into practical terms. It means family. Therefore, yes, this doesn't make a difference. The definition, the inherent definition of a Jew, status of a Jew, remains whether a person is doing what he needs to be doing or not, and whether he acknowledges Hashem or not, because Amaisi is family. Family doesn't change. A person can become a very rebellious son who gives his parents a lot of grief, but family remains family. The Jew is family of Hashem. Which means that inherently it's supposed to be a relationship with love. And the truth is that any of the growth that we can get out of the 3 weeks only comes from this perspective. From the perspective of love. Because the 3 weeks is about missing Hashem. It's about missing Hashem. If a person is just an Oved Hashem, as a Yirei Shamayim, in the most basic sense, he does what he has to do because he knows that he has to do what he has to do. You know, you have to keep your nose clean. Otherwise you get in trouble in the next world. So, there's no reason for such a person to be sad in the 3 weeks. Again, I'm keeping my nose clean and that's all. The growth that can come out of the 3 weeks can only come from the perspective of a person who senses that, yes, I am family with Hashem Kiviyachol. And really, we are supposed to be closer together. And therefore, the truth is that in a sense, the 3 weeks really, that Bein HaMitzarim I should call it, 3 weeks is just the broader, right? Ends up concentrating into the 9 days, concentrating into Tisha B'Av. There are also different points in the day of Tisha B'Av. But really, that's the perspective through which we're supposed to view all of our Yiddishkeit. Let's note that One of the first halachas in Shulchan Aruch is Roy Lekol Yerei Shemayim Sheyemitza V'Doyeg Al Churban Beis Hamikdash. One of the first halachas is the halacha that you're supposed to be sad about the Churban is not stated in Hilchas Tishba. It's stated in the first siman in Shulchan Aruch. Second or third seif in Shulchan Aruch. Meaning that one of the most fundamental aspects of a Jew's consciousness in our time is supposed to be the fact that I'm not with Hashem and this is not a natural situation. What does it mean that we're not with Hashem? You can connect to Hashem in the same way. So we think when we hear about, you know, the Churban and getting the Beis Hamikdash back, we think in very technical terms because all we hear described are technical details. We'll have the Beis Hamikdash, we'll be able to bring Karbanos. What does all that mean? It's very difficult to really miss the Beis Hamikdash and the Karbanos. We never had them. We appreciate a rich life without it. Our lives are fine. We can even appreciate rich Judaism without it. Rich spiritual life. There's a lot of Ruchnius out there. When do we say that, oh yes, we need the Geula? Well, we have specific tzaris, we hear people saying. You know, there are tzaris. Klal Yisrael has tzaris, and therefore we need the Geula. But the very fact that we don't have the Geula, it's hard for people to relate to as a tzara. I was born into that. And I live with it fine. So let's try to bring this issue home a little bit more. Just in order to be able to appreciate what we're missing here. And how this really is supposed to guide us all throughout the year. So let's say I have an orphan. There was such an incident. This actually occurred. Where an orphan whose mother had died, a girl, her mother had died when she was an infant. She never really knew her mother, didn't remember her mother at all. When she was shown a picture of her mother, she knew that she was already an older girl, I know she was 10, 11, and she knew that, you know, she's expected to respond duly. So she looked at the picture and she said, wow, what a tzaddikus. She knew she was supposed to say something nice. Wow, what a tzaddikus. Anybody who looks at that, sees, you know, just can't help but be touched by the tragic a manifestation of her state. It's not that tsmami, it's wow, what a tzaddikus, right? Oh yeah, that looks like a special woman. Doesn't mean anything to me. It could be I could see a different picture of another Rebbetzin also. Or a picture of a tisha of mine might mean more to me. But I see that she's a special woman. This is in a big sense when we're hearing all the different descriptions of what it was like in the Beis HaMikdash, how the Karbanos were. We hear about the different miracles that were in the Beis HaMikdash. And we think, oh, that sounds very special. But how bad is life now as is? Yeah, it would be very nice. It's an added thing. But how bad is life now as is? You have to realize that that's exactly the tragedy. Let's give a bit of a mashal to this. The tragedy really is exactly that point that we described. An orphan girl who has no idea what it means to have a relationship with a mother and therefore doesn't see anything that she's missing in that picture except for a nice woman. She knows nice women. This would be another nice woman to know. So yes, there might be certain advantages to living with a Beis HaMikdash. So let's give a mashal that we've given a few times. And those who have heard it before, bear with me please. Let's give the mashal that we've given a few times in the past. About two boys. Two brothers. Who got lost together in the forest, the jungle. Came from an affluent home, got lost together in the jungle, somehow or the other. And one of them is 3 years old at the time. The other is 13. And they're living together in the jungle. They're learning to make do. 13-year-old is a capable kid. They learn to adapt to life in the jungle. And the 3-year-old grows up with the 13-year-old as his mentor, and some years go by, and the 3-year-old is now 8 or 9 years old, and life in the jungle is now a reality. They learned the ropes. They know what foods you can eat, what foods you can't eat, how to look for food, how to avoid danger. They know how to set themselves up comfortably for night, for the nighttime in trees. They know which trees to climb on. They know which leaves are more comfortable, which leaves don't cause reactions, etc. They know the ropes. Their life isn't a bad life. There's variation. Sometimes when the pickings are rough, they eat leaves. Sometimes there's passion fruit and breadfruit. Okay, fine. Now, the 9-year-old / 3-year-old kid doesn't remember a life other than this. He doesn't remember a life other than this. This is where he grew up, and this is what it's all about. A great day, as far as he's concerned, is a day when there are a lot of leaves to make a comfortable bed, and you wake up in the morning and there's breadfruit for breakfast. That's a great day. The older brother, he also adapted to life in the jungle, but a comfortable bed of leaves and breadfruit in the morning doesn't satisfy him. Just makes him more and more wistful. And the younger brother sees that as good as life is, you know, even when there are, you know, when they haven't seen a hyena in weeks, which is really, you know, life is great, the older brother is never completely happy. And he asks him about it, and he describes, he says, I don't know where we came from. I can never be happy where we are now. We came from a home, a warm home, with parents who cared for us, where there weren't hyenas anywhere in the city, right? And to get bread food, see, the breakfast, the lunch and supper, 3 meals a day, the types of food that mommy used to make, right? And he describes it all to him. And he describes to him what a warm bed means. And not having to worry about being shielded by branches from the elements. There's a house. There's something called a house. Which actually, there's a set thing that always is over your head, blocking you from the elements. And the kid is trying to imagine it. And it sounds great. You know, it really does sound utopian. 3 meals a day, you don't have to go looking for it. You don't have to worry about hyenas. You don't have to worry at night about setting up a leaf bed. The way he describes a mattress sounds very appealing. But it's all very nice, but life isn't bad. Life is definitely tolerable. This is what he's grown up with. This is what he's used to. This is life. There is that theoretical, abstract, utopian image of something called a house. Which, you know, he thinks of from time to time. It would be nice to be back there, but right now he's involved with his life. This is life, and this is reality. Now, there's another strange twist to this. That is, that besides everything else, when the older brother starts talking about it, he gets wistful, even teary-eyed. When he talks about mother's supper, he gets teary-eyed. And this the younger kid can't understand, because fine, we talk about good food. He knows his brother is a rough guy, he's a tough guy. Why should he get emotional over the thought of chicken soup as opposed to passion fruit? What's emotional about that? Yeah, better food is better. He also likes better food better than worse food. Why should he get emotional about that? Why should he get emotional about sleeping in a bed as opposed to leaves? It's not his older brother's type. His older brother is a tough guy. And the older brother tries to explain to him, no, it's not the bed and it's not the food per se. It's living at home with a mother and a father. That turns all the bed and the food and all these three different things are just symptoms, they're just manifestations. But that's not really the quality of it. It's a whole different quality of life when you live at home with a mother and a father. And the younger kid can't grasp anything except for the technical aspect that the food is better, the bed is better, and they're the ones who supply that. So, he just can't connect to the emotional side of it. Technical, sounds nice, but life is definitely bearable. This is what he's always been used to. And why should he want much more? Or why should he yearn for? Why should he feel every day like life is not life? It's very hard to feel that way. So we have to realize that the truth is that this is exactly what describes our state. the tragedy, right? Like that famous line. We have to weep over the fact that we don't sense what we need to weep for. Meaning, all the descriptions of the Beis HaMikdash, etc., etc., is really just representing a much more fundamental reality, and that is living close to Hashem, which is what the natural state of the Jewish people is supposed to be. The existence that we know now, that we were born into, and feel fine with, and we even feel close with Hashem. Because the truth is, we can get close with Hashem at this level, is actually not the Judaism we were meant to live. And when I say Judaism, Judaism means life experience. This is not the how life was meant to be experienced. This is not what Olam Hazeh is meant to be. Olam Hazeh is turned off. It's mamish like the kid living out in the jungle. We're talking about a completely different quality of life, which can't be described in terms of physical manifestations, in terms of symptoms. Because we're talking about a different quality of life, the life of sensing the closeness of Hashem. And here I want to step back a little bit and try to describe it a little more in the way Kuzari does. In earlier times, when people lived with the Shekhinah, Kuzari says, we've just been discussing this in the Kuzari Shiva. Kuzari says, why is it that the Torah doesn't discuss, only discusses material rewards? It doesn't discuss Olam Haba. Why does it only discuss material rewards? You'll have a lot of rain, right? You'll have peace, you'll have health. Why does the Torah discuss that, not Olam Haba? Because Ari says something astounding. He says, actually, Olam Haba is meant to be experienced in this world. But we just hear rain, health, peace. It sounds like a pretty nice existence along the lines that we're used to, just in the most optimal state. But really, he says, the point is not the peace, health, and rain, financial substance. That's not really the point. The point is the experience of living in Eretz Yisrael with the Shekhinah. I'll give an example, right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe gave out dollars. If you ever went to a Lubavitcher's house, you see it framed. You see the dollar framed. Right? Now, why are you so excited that he has a dollar? I have 10. I have more than 10. I have 100. He won't trade his dollar for a 10. Why not? But the point is not, wow, look how great my Rebbe is. He gave me a dollar and I can buy 4 bags of potato chips with it. You're a person in a superficial way, that's how you would take it. That's a great man. He gives out dollars to the people he likes. Well, what's the point? No. They're not going to buy 4 bags of potato chips with this dollar. They're going to hold on to the dollar because of the one they got it from. That's what it means to them. The one they got it from. When a person receives something, I had a cousin who saved the candy that he got from Rav Shach for many years. It was an Israeli candy. I had much better ones. But saved the candy that he got from Rav Shach for many years. So, because sometimes the experience of getting it and the one you got it from way overshadows the technical aspect of what it is you've got. So, Kuzari says this is really the point when we're talking about the material benefits of Eretz Yisrael. Today, we just hear these things and what's it supposed to mean? But when you look in Eretz Yisrael and you saw how in an unnatural way Hashem is actually giving you these things, it was a completely different life's experience. It was an exhilarating experience. To feel Hashem pat you on the back. You were tired on your Shmiras Haloshim lately, and therefore, here, I'm going to put rain specifically on your field. Right? A person bounded for joy just because of the fact that Hashem related to him in a personal way. That is an example we often give. There's a lot of such examples. We talk about, and Gemara is talking about, the unbelievable quality, the unbelievable sweetness of the fruits of Eretz Yisrael. That's why we want to get Mashiach, right? Today, again, in Eretz Yisrael, we're in the state of Eretz Yisrael, but it's like coming back to the house when the parents are not there. It's nice. But that's not it. We talk about the unnatural sweetness of the fruit. That's what's so great about Eretz Yisrael. That's what's so great about having. That's why I want to make something like that. Because now apples are only so sweet, but when Mashiach comes, an apple will be an apple, right? That's what That's what we're sitting on the floor over on Tisha B'Av. We're sitting on the floor and we're saying, this is a watermelon. Ah. Even in America there are better watermelons. Is that... No, that's not what we're... That's not the point. Or, right, Chazal say, that when the Jewish people were living the way they should be living, wheat grew to the size of kidneys. Meaning that each wheat berry, which today is like this big, right? The barley that you have in your challenge is puffed, right? Tiny, this big. Wheat in those days grew to this, was this size. That's how great it was in Eretz Yisrael. Wheat berries were this size. They say, what's so great about that? What's so great about that? That instead of actually having to make a sandwich out of a lot of wheat berries that are ground and kneaded together, one wheat berry is a sandwich. Ah! That's why it's so great to live in the times of Mashiach. No, that's not the point. The point is that when you know that wheat berries are meant to be this big, that's how wheat berries are in the natural world, and you came out to your field and you see in your field a wheat berry this big, that was a personal stroke on the cheek from Hashem. That was what was so exciting about it. Now, the truth is that these are the less pronounced manifestations of it. It was able to be much more nevuah, right? In those days, in those great days, when Hashem lived with the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael in the most open way, Mamish had the Shechina there. The Beis HaMikdash was Hashem's apartment, kiviyachol, Hashem's headquarters. You knew that was Hashem's address, which meant that Hashem was busy, involved in an intimate way, in a personal level, with all the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. The closer you got to Yerushalayim, the more manifest it was. But yes, Hashem was openly available for people to connect in a live way. Nevuah. Anybody can aspire to Nevuah. Anybody was able to reach it. Chazal tell us that there were 1.2 million Nevi'im among Klal Yisrael. We only know of the famous 48 because those were the ones who were conveying Nevuah to the Jewish people for all generations. Those were the public Nevi'im. Those were the national level Nevi'im. But there were plenty of people who were getting Nevuah on a personal level that didn't need to be recorded because it didn't have any, wasn't relevant to the crowd at large. But there was 1.2 million people throughout the period of Nevuah that got Nevuah. I once made a cheshbon, it comes out approximately a Navi in every three buildings, if we're talking in our terms today. In our terms today, it means that in every three buildings there was a Navi. If you make the cheshbon of the generations and spreading it out, that's how it comes out. There were more Nevi'im than there were Rabbanim, right? Today we have plenty of Rabbanim in the neighborhood. There were much more Nevi'im than there were Rabbanim. You went to a minyan in Shul, there were seven people, seven Nevi'im in your minyan. Right? And what was Nevuah? So Nevuah also, from today's perspective, we understand it as a technicality. Hashem needed to get across a message, tap someone on the shoulder, hey, can you tell the people that? Hashem spoke to someone. Nevuah, the Kuzari says, this is the reason that the Torah didn't discuss Olam Haba. It didn't need to discuss Olam Haba because you can experience it in this world. When Hashem actually connected to a person and interacted with him on a personal level, the person was experiencing the most blissful state that anyone could possibly be in this world. That was the beginning of Olam Haba. And it was so intense, the Kuzari says, that even a person watching a Navi, when he got the Nevuah, when you saw it coming over, when you saw the state he went into, they would fall down off it. They couldn't stay on their feet when they were actually touched by Hashem. They fell down and went into a certain state. So the person who saw a Navi getting Nevuah was so inspired that he was a changed person forever. The Kuzari says, if you saw a Navi getting Nevuah, materialism, you became detached from material. Gashmius just lost all its significance to you for the rest of your life. There's a person who became a more elevated person. That's a person watching someone get divorced. Meaning we're talking about living a level of life that our life today, the way Kuzari puts it, we're talking quality-wise, our life today is mamish, the quality of life, the quality of Judaism, the vitality of Judaism today is like the difference between a dead body and a live body. Our Judaism today is dead. dead. There's so much Yiddishkeit out there. There's so much Ruchnius. It's true. It's true. But we're talking relatively. And this is part of the point we're trying to bring home. We say that our Yiddishkeit is dead. Let's not just understand that as Yiddishkeit. It means our life's experience is dead. We are living in numb. We're not living in the real world. What a shame to go through life numb to what life is really meant to be. The quality of life, the experience of life is meant to be something so much more charged, so much more thrilling, so much more full and rich, so much more warm. But the experiencing Hashem's love in a live way is the ultimate bliss that a person could ever feel. And this is how it was back in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash, by the way, was already the beginning of the Golos. They didn't have this to this extent. They had it to a certain extent. It was already the beginning of the Golos. In the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, therefore the Sfarim say that we can't even begin to relate to what a person walking through the street felt at that time. And so the Gros says, for example, that we have no idea of the greatness of the children back in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. Because we're talking about living in a world that's turned off. It's not plugged in. You can't begin to relate. When you see a machine in a box, can you picture how it works when it's actually on and plugged in? Okay, if you have an idea of how the machine works, fine. But we're talking about experiencing life on a completely different level. Just give a little bit of a muscle of the concept of what we're trying to convey here, because again, we're talking about things that, as far as we're concerned, are abstract, because we never experienced life on a different level. So as far as we're concerned, this is the ultimate experience of life. Well, let me give another little muscle to what we're trying to convey here. Chazal say, "Im Rishonim k'malachim anu k'bnei Adam, Im Rishonim k'bnei Adam anu k'chamayim." If the earlier ones are like angels, we're like people. If they're like people, we're like donkeys. Now let's understand the profundity of this statement, because this will help drive the point home. Have you ever been to a show that you really enjoyed? Or have you ever watched a scene that you really enjoyed? Have you ever watched a scene that was very, very moving, very touching? Whatever the experience was, there were also pigeons. Usually, there were also pigeons watching the scene. Right? Or cats. Or bugs. They saw the same thing you saw. Did they experience the same thing you experienced? They're completely out of touch with what's going on. They see exactly the same thing. They see the exact same movements, and it means nothing to them because they are not attuned to what you're attuned to. Right? So therefore, for example, you walk outside with your pet donkey, right? We're giving the mashal Chazal talked about donkey as opposed to people. You walk outside with your pet donkey on a leash. Probably more friendly animals than the dogs that run around here. But you walk outside with the donkey on a leash, and there is a brand new model car. Newest, slickest model, and you look at it, and it means something to you, right? There's significance there. You're noting all the different things. The donkey is noting all those things too, but all it means to him is black. Right? It could be the same thing if it was a big black box, cardboard box. But it's not that you are thinking about it and you're understanding it. You're living in a different plane of reality than he is. You're both in the same place, but you're in a completely different plane of reality. The people who lived in the earlier times, in the times of the first place, HaMikdash, were living in a completely different plane of reality. What they experienced when they were walking through the street is the same as what you experience when you, the same as the difference between what you experience at a wedding and what a fly experiences at that same wedding. None of the excitement, none of the emotion, nothing. Right? We have to work so hard to tune into a little bit of Ruchnius. And we do. Relatively for us, it's an awful lot. But again, it's off. The machines are off. And then the guy takes it a little bit further. Kuzari says, yes, it's to the extent that our experience of life compared to their experience of life is like the difference between a dead body and a live body. That was the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. It was a completely different plane of reality. What defined that different plane of reality? They lived fearing Hashem, not because they needed to work to feel it, but Hashem was there in their lives in a tangible, real, sensory way. Even the people who weren't Nevi'im, it was a completely different life experience. And us trying to tap into that is mamish the same as the kid trying to tap into the concept of a mother's love, of living with a mother's love when he never knew his mother. He can't tap into it. It's very difficult. We're talking about a completely different level of consciousness. Now the Gra takes this further, and you'll excuse the example he gives. He says the difference between when there was a nevuah and after there was a nevuah, the first Beis HaMikdash and afterwards, was the difference between a live body and a dead body. But that's talking about the period after the Churban. Meaning, we're talking about the great people, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, okay, Shimon HaTzadik. The difference between Shimon HaTzadik's life experience and the experience of someone who lives in the first place of Mikdash is the difference between a live body and a dead body. He says, from then till today, it's already not a dead body anymore. It's a spoonful of mush that's left after the body has been decomposing over many years. That's the state that we're in today, relative to what was back then. So, we talk about all these things, it remains abstract to us, but the point is to remember that no, we were meant to be living in a completely different life experience. Yes, life experience that we can't connect to right now. And as far as we're concerned, we might feel that, okay, I can kind of appreciate it, but at the end of the day, this life is not a tragedy. It's tolerable. So here we come to the main point, or the final point. Why is it? We come back to what Reb Nachman said. Again, why is it that we're not experiencing all this today? Because Hashem is not with us now. And here we have a big test. We go back, let's go back all the way back to what we started beginning. What is our fundamental definition? Our fundamental definition is family with Hashem. And here we're tested. Often, a relationship is going to be tested in the tough times. Right? A man and woman get married, and they're talking about the beautiful life ahead. As long as they're living together, it'll be beautiful. And then the wife says, but what happens if we can't be together for whatever reason? So the man will respond, well then, you know, move on and go about business. The wife says, so we don't have a real relationship. We don't have a real relationship. So here's the question. Now that we are not with Hashem, do we care? Do we care, or are we fine with that? Hashem cares. Hashem cares very deeply. Hashem Kiviyachol never got over it. And he's still weeping about the distance today, just as he did at the time. And he's still longing to be close with us, to draw us close, to live with us in his embrace, just like we did then. Hashem is longing for this. He's longing for this with each and every one of us in an individual way. Hashem wants that. Hashem cares. And it hurts Hashem Kiviyachol that we are distanced from him. And here is the big question. Do we care? Or are we fine? Alright, Hashem cares, but I have my life worked out. It'll be nice when it happens in the theoretical abstract future, right? Not within the next couple of weeks, because it'll mess up plans. Right? So I have vacation plans for after Tisha B'Av. But we can live with life now, right? It'll be nice when it happens. We can live with life now. Can we live with life knowing that Hashem is longing to be back with us? Or is it reciprocal? We say, Hashem, we know you're longing to be back with us, and we want to be back with you too. And therefore, yes, we spend these 3 weeks culminating with the 9 days, culminating with Tisha B'Av, with the feeling of focusing on the fact that this is what we meant when we said a moed of richuk. It's a big test of the quality of our relationship with Hashem. How do we work with the distance? Is the distance a problem for us? Usually, our relationship with Hashem is built on closeness, shalish regalim, etc. But a very fundamental test of the relationship is, what is the feeling like when you're distant? do you feel an even more intense love and longing to be back together? Or do you feel like, alright, you have to adjust to reality and move on? This is what we're meant to be feeling now. And the truth is that this is really what the Shulchan Aruch means when he says this is really supposed to be a part of the Jew, conscientious Jew's consciousness all year round, not just in the Shalosh Regalim, because the most fundamental aspect of our reality today is the fact that we're not with Hashem. It's very nice. We learn Torah, we do mitzvahs, but all that is such a diluted form of the Yiddishkeit that we're really meant to live. All that is such a diluted form, a faint form of the Olam Hazeh Hashem really had set up for us. Hashem had set up for us to be living with Him in His embrace, to be living with His warmth on a regular basis, and He wants that. And the question is, how do we relate? That's the big question we need to be asking ourselves throughout these 3 weeks. He cares. Do we care? Or is the situation such that He cares, He longs, He misses, and we've already set up our life and we're doing fine? Is it going to be like Hashem hid His face because we weren't appreciating the relationship with Him? And at the time that He hid His face, it did jolt us into awareness. Are we going to desperately seek out that awareness even more? Or are we just going to sail along and float away? And the truth is that when we're going to get it back actually very much depends on this. The back of Emden says that in all likelihood the biggest thing that's holding back the Geula is the fact that we don't want it enough. You hear people asking, oh, what is Hashem waiting for? What is Hashem waiting for? How long is it supposed to take? People ask this, but the question is, how badly do we want it? Do we feel desperate about it? It could be that it's not meant to take all that long. It could be that it didn't have to take all that long. It could be that it just requires enough of a level of us wanting it, of us seeking it out. Tzion he donation la mechlad abayi drisha, the Gemara says. Tzion is, nobody is seeking it out. Nobody's looking for that reinstatement of living with Hashem. It requires a certain quota of begging for it, of longing for it, of crying about it, in order to get it back. Say, it's taking so long, but the question is, yes, in all that long period, how many, what percentage of the Jewish people have been desperately focused on it? Right? We say about a third of our Shemana Esrei is dedicated to that. How many of those brachas have we just kind of mumbled through for years? Maybe it doesn't take all that much, but maybe a couple of hundred Shemana Esreis, we have thousands of Jews, a couple of hundred Shemana Esreis with serious intent begging to be reunited with Hashem, maybe they simply haven't happened. Maybe enough haven't happened yet. So that's really the question. We have to ask ourselves, are we desperately longing for it? Do we want it? And if we do, so first of all, that itself is already an access to Hashem. That itself already brings us closer to Hashem. The very fact that we are pained by the fact that we're far from Him is already bringing us closer. And that's what we mean by the concept of moyed of richok, a moyed of distance. And besides that, there's a Hashem. Yes, the more longing we feel, the more tefillah, heartfelt tefillah we put into it, is actually moving it closer and closer to actually heaven.